Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
He is of the old school, the Chamber of Commerce, Business and Manufacturers Republican Party, and Murkowski completely fits the bill.
The donor behind the biggest contributions to Senator Lisa Murkowski's re-election campaign. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 20th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a fifth bear is killed at an Anchorage campground the city opened to the homeless.
Having a lot of people experiencing homelessness in that campground, it's right next to a never-ending supply of bears.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
A woman who allegedly told detectives she had wanted to become a serial killer faces murder charges in the deaths of 2 men in Anchorage earlier this month. Bail was set for $1 million for Brianna Starr Wassily on Tuesday. Wassily also faces a charge of misconduct involving a corpse. The state's online court records system shows the public defender agency is representing her. Prosecutor Assistant District Attorney Alice Kersey said the killings lacked a clear motive. She also said Wassily told detectives she had wanted to become a serial killer since she was a child, according to an Anchorage Daily News report. Wassily, 24, was described as homeless in an arrest warrant. A complaint signed by an Anchorage police detective said Wassily has no prior criminal convictions in Alaska. She's charged in the July 3rd deaths of Gregory Pitka, 34, and Travis Sheldon, 36. It was not clear whether Wassily previously knew either of them, and Tuesday's hearing did not shed any light on that. The complaint alleges that Wassily, after being brought in for questioning by police, admitted to killing the men. It says detectives had connected her to the crimes after letters were found last week along with Pitka's ID behind a retail store in Anchorage. The complaint says she admitted to writing the letters. State Fish and Game officials are concerned about human bear encounters at an Anchorage campground that the city opened to more than 200 houseless residents last month. Since then, 5 bears have been shot, including one today. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more.
Bears have been a problem at Centennial Campground the past few weeks since the city waived camping fees and directed houseless people there. Following reports of bears getting into tents, biologists shot a female black bear and 2 cubs, as well as an unrelated male black bear at the campground July 6th. Fish and Game area biologist Dave Battle says Alaska wildlife troopers shot a 5th bear Wednesday morning.
I understand that there's another sow with a cub that is also sniffing around. She may or may not have entered tents. We're not sure yet, but so we have another possible situation coming up.
More than 200 houseless people are currently camping at Centennial. Battle says the biggest issue is campers leaving food in their tents. He says ordinarily, city parks and rec staff are able to closely monitor campers at the campgrounds and evict people for not following safety guidelines. He says since houseless people were moved to the site, the ability to monitor and police the campsites is more difficult. One reason is due to a hesitancy from staff to evict houseless people, and the other is because security can't search people's tents.
We know that there's food in a lot of the tents in Centennial, and there doesn't seem to be anything anyone can do about it.
City officials moved many houseless people to the Centennial Campground after the Sullivan Arena mass shelter closed at the end of June and after clearing homeless camps in Davis Park and along Chester Creek. In an interview with Alaska Public Media Wednesday, Mayor Dave Bronson said the campground was a safer place for houseless people than the Sullivan or the 2 camping areas that were cleared out.
This is a big improvement over Davis Park. We are providing hot and cold running water. We're providing showers. We're providing toilet paper. We're providing a campsite. Volunteer groups came in and actually provided tents. And so this is a vast improvement. We've got a place now where we've got everyone centralized, where we can see everyone.
Battle says Fish and Game wasn't consulted by the mayor's administration before the city moved to consolidate houseless people at Centennial.
The location of Centennial Campground and having a lot of people experiencing homelessness in that campground, it's right next to a never-ending supply of bears.
Battle says the bears are only deemed threats when they start to rummage through campers' tents. He says he's worried about the long-term feasibility of a large houseless population at the campground.
You know, every bear we kill, it's just a Band-Aid. That the next week, another bear is going to find that campground and we're going to be right back in the same situation. Bears are going to be trying to come into tents, and those people that are there are going to be put into danger.
Battle's suggestion is that houseless people are directed to another location. He says if that isn't possible, then service providers in the area need to drastically increase the amount of bear-resistant containers they're distributing to campers.
I know I see bear-resistant containers there, so like I say, the city is you know, the staff there are doing the best job that they can. And they can supply the bear-resistant containers. I don't know if they can get everyone to use the bear-resistant containers.
Bronson spokesman Corey Allen Young says there are currently bear-resistant containers throughout the campground, some of which were recently purchased by the city. He says parks officials conduct hourly sweeps to pick up trash and food. As for long-term sheltering options, Mayor Bronson says that his administration hopes they can begin housing people at the new Navigation Center in mid-October. Construction on that project has yet to begin. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
In the U.S. Senate race, an independent group working to re-elect Senator Lisa Murkowski and attack her rival has amassed a huge amount of money. The Political Action Committee has raised $2.4 million in 3 months. That's about $1 million more than what Murkowski's own campaign raised and four times as much as challenger Kelly Chewbacca took in for the second quarter. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports on where the PAC gets its money and what it's doing with it.
Maybe you got the anti-Chewbacca mailer about birth control or heard the ad.
Alaskans for Lisa is responsible for the content of this advertisement. Alaskans' access to basic birth control is being threatened by Kelly Chewbacca.
Alaskans for Lisa is separate from Murkowski's campaign. It has to be by law because as an independent super PAC, it can collect contributions in unlimited amounts. The biggest contributor by far is hedge fund founder Kenneth Griffin, who didn't respond to inquiries for this story. He has given Alaskans for Lisa $1.5 million.
He is of the old school, the Chamber of Commerce, Business and Manufacturers Republican Party, not the evangelical right. And Murkowski completely fits the bill.
Don Wiener is an investigator at the Center for Media and Democracy based in Wisconsin. Wiener has never spoken to Griffin, but he's analyzed his contributions.
If you combine state campaigns and federal campaigns, you combine them together, he's the largest political contributor in the entire country on the Republican side.
Alaskans for Lisa is run by, among others, Murkowski's former chief of staff, Mike Pawlowski, former legislator Jerry Mackey, political consultant Jim Lotzfeld, and attorney Scott Kendall. Another notable contributor is James Murdoch, the younger brother of Fox News chairman Lachlan Murdoch. James and his wife Catherine each contributed $125,000 to Alaskans for Lisa. Two of the ads the group has produced so far attack Chewbacca, a Republican running to the right of Murkowski. One is based on Chewbacca's remarks at a campaign event in March when she said she'd like to ban abortion pills by mail. A man in the audience asks about birth control pills.
So then does birth control fall underneath that same category kind
of thing? Well, it would.
Yeah.
Despite what she said on that recording, the Chewbacca campaign says Chewbacca does not want to outlaw birth control pills or restrict their delivery by mail. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Coming up on Alaska News Nightly, the Kenai River King Salmon Fishery closes early for the third year in a row.
2 years ago, the 28th was our last fishing day. Last year, the 23rd was our last fishing day. So is this earlier? Oh my God, yes.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Widespread rain is expected to fall again throughout south-central Alaska tonight through Saturday. The National Weather Service issued a flood advisory late yesterday afternoon for Anchorage and the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. The flood advisory is in effect until 4 a.m. Saturday morning. Officials in the Matsu Borough are asking residents to monitor rising water levels. In a report today, they said property owners along the Little Sioux River, the Big Sioux River in Talkeetna, and Willow Creek should be prepared to leave if necessary. And showery weather is allowing crews working the Clear Fire in interior Alaska to secure protection along areas of the 72,000-acre wildfire's perimeter. In an update yesterday, Incident Management Team Operations Chief Scott Schrank highlighted areas where additional work is being done, including on the fire's north side.
Get everything completely mopped up, all threats removed from the homes, and then backhaul out a lot of structural protection gear.
Schrank said firefighters are also working to secure the fire's east flank in the vicinity of Anderson and Clear Space Force Station.
We want very locked in, secure line all on the entire eastern perimeter. And then over time, we'll begin some of the suppression, repair, and rehab of some of those dozer lines.
And finally, they're working along portions of the fire's southern edge as well.
We're just going around the clusters of homes, putting in line as needed. Tying in, you know, like wet area to wet area and getting a secure saw line around all the homes.
485 firefighters were assigned to the Clear Fire as of yesterday. Fishing for Chinook salmon on the Kenai River is again off limits this month. It's the third year in a row the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has closed the fishery early amid low king counts. And it also means set netters who fish the east side of Cook Inlet are not allowed to fish anymore this season. Their fishery closes when king counts are low. The port run may not come as a surprise to most, though. King salmon have been on the downswing in Alaska for more than a decade. Still, it's worrying for sport and commercial fishermen who will now have to change their plans in the face of a truncated season. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
Ray DeBartolabens, president of the Kenai River Professional Guide Association, and he owns the aptly named guide business, Long Live the Kings.
Although we do need to conserve these fish and we need to do it, I just hope one day, and still have hope that these fish will come back.
He says clients used to return to his business year after year to try and catch the Kenai River trophy fish. But king salmon have been struggling on the Kenai and around Alaska. Biologists say they don't really know why. On top of the poor runs in south-central Alaska, Fish and Game said Tuesday that this year's run on the Yukon River might be the lowest ever observed. Fish and Game says it wants the late Kenai King run to fall between 15,000 to 30,000 large king salmon. That's what it calls its optimal escapement goal for the run. But it estimates that under current conditions, only 11,500 kings would pass under the radar by the end of the run. With the limits on king fishing, DeBartolabin says he tells guides they have to diversify to other types of fish, bringing clients along to catch sockeye for the peak of the run in the summer, as well as halibut and trout. He says his regular clients are generally understanding of the new reality.
When people call to book trips with me, I just tell them we're going fishing. For where, for what, I don't know. But we're going to get in my boat, we're going to go have some fun, and we're going to catch some fish, and maybe not catch fish. It's just a new kind of lifestyle as a Kenai River guide and could see off rivers.
Still, he says it's hard on guides, especially the newer ones.
The guide numbers are definitely going to be down, you know, this year.
Not all groups are able to pivot when their fishery is limited. The Eastside set net fishery is shut down, meaning set netters from Nanilchik to the northern Kenai Peninsula won't have any more openers unless king abundance improves. This is the fourth year in a row they've had closures due to low king salmon escapement. Setnetter Brent Johnson of Clam Gulch says he was worried there would be a closure, but he says this year's came even earlier than most.
2 years ago, the 28th was our last fishing day. Last year, the 23rd was our last fishing day. So is this earlier? Oh, my God, yes.
He says his site grossed about $56,000 this season. That's on par with how much he made in 2012, which he called another doomsday year.
So this will be like tying the record for the all-time worst, except with inflation, of course. $56,000 is worse in 2022 than it is in 2012.
He says he's having his crew work on cabin maintenance at the SetNet site for the last few weeks of the season, so to not leave them high and dry without work. The paired restrictions on the SetNetters are meant to curb incidental king salmon catch. The Alaska Board of Fisheries says SetNetters are more likely to catch kings than the drift fleet is, since they fish closer to the shore. But SetNetters say they've been able to get creative to avoid catching kings in their nets. They've caught approximately 32 large king salmon so far this month, according to Fish and Game. That's a small fraction of the total king run. Ken Coleman is vice president of the Kenai Peninsula Fishermen's Association, which represents local SetNetters.
Every conceivable type of user is out there harvesting at a high rate. And we're being closed for the fourth year in a row early, and it's devastating.
He also says the closures were somewhat expected. This spring, anticipating the closures, the Alaska Board of Fish considered an out-of-cycle proposal that would have opened a limited SetNet fishery this year. But that proposal garnered significant pushback from sport fishing advocates and was narrowly defeated by the board.
So moving forward, we'd like to find a way to make that kind of a situation work. So if we're in this bright red area where we're completely closed and facing another disaster season, there would be some way to do some limited harvest.
Coleman says SetNetters, most of whom are from the central Kenai Peninsula, are hurting. He also says he's worried about over-escapement of sockeye salmon in the Kenai and Kisilof rivers if the SetNetters aren't allowed to fish.
We've got some time between now and the next board meeting. 2024 is the next meeting. It's a ways away, and there could be more pain between then and now. I certainly hope not.
For now, he says the fleet will have to watch the sockeye jump from the beach. The restrictions on sport fishing in the Kenai and Kisilof rivers means catch and release king fishing there is also not allowed. Fish and Game is prohibiting the use of bait and multiple hooks from the mouth of the Kenai River to the outlet of Skilak Lake. Meanwhile, king retention also is not allowed in the personal use fishery during dipnet season. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
The small community of Moose Pass has existed since before highways were built on the Kenai Peninsula. But now, an Alaska Department of Transportation plan to resurface and restore the road has residents afraid that construction on the Seward Highway will cause irreparable damage to their town. KDLL's Riley Board has more.
Wedged between the water of Trail Lake to the east and mountains to the west, Moose Pass hugs the Seward Highway closely. The state has long wanted to update a 10.5-mile stretch of the one-lane highway and improve drainage there by constructing ditches along the side of the highway. This year, the Department of Transportation is hoping to start securing right-of-way acquisitions in order to build those ditches, pending approval by the Kenai Peninsula Borough Planning Commission.
The little old Alaskan downtown look that we've had here forever, which kind of makes Moose Pass unique, will be gone.
That's Moose Pass resident John Smart. He's taken on the role of communications for Preserve and Protect Moose Pass, a cohort of community members who have gathered to oppose the current plan for the project and brainstorm a more favorable path forward.
All the old growth trees will be taken back, and we'll have people's front yards on the roadway, and it won't be the same easy-going, simple-looking American/Alaskan town that we've had before.
Smart says, like many residents, he knows the road needs work. He's just not happy with the way DOT is going about the project. Many of Preserve and Protect Moose Pass's complaints relate to the change in scope of the project. From the residents' perspective, the scope changes were accompanied by a lack of communication with local residents. Justin Shelby, an administrative operations manager for the department, says the current project has been scaled down from a larger rehab project, partially as a result of concerns from the community about impact. Shelby says constructing the drainage ditches is an important part of extending the life of the roadway. They drain surface and subsurface water from the road, in addition to storing snow and catching runaway vehicles.
Resurfacing the roadway without addressing the root causes of the degradation of the roadway would not meet the purpose of the project.
In fact, Shelby says in Moose Pass, DOT is proposing narrower ditches than it usually would to accommodate the private properties close to the roadway. Still, members of the community say they worry about the removal of old-growth trees, elimination of the parking areas of businesses, and disruption of septic tanks. Many Moose Pass residents will have their driveways modified, relocated, or removed as a result of this project. One business that will be affected by the rehab project is the Estes Brothers store. Jeff Estes is concerned about how the project will affect his business. He says the proposed right-of-way, if secured, would cut through about one-third of the store itself.
Does that mean they're going to move the store? I have to move the store?
He says that the project would affect the entryway to the store, which sits on the side of the building that faces the road. And the other option, putting the entryway on the back of the store, just doesn't make good business sense. Smart says for now, Preserve and Protect Moose Pass hopes to buy time while working on a solution. The Borough Planning Commission has already postponed a vote on the department's proposal to give the Moose Pass Advisory Planning Commission time to review it. Then, the Borough Planning Commission will vote on whether the plan meets borough code. But even if they give it the green light, DOT will still have to seek funding to take next steps. In Moose Pass, I'm Riley Board.
A new totem pole honoring missing and murdered Indigenous women will be raised in the Prince of Wales Island community of Klawak at the end of this month. A Prince of Wales domestic violence advocacy organization called Helping Ourselves Prevent Emergencies is organizing the event. Tiffany Mills is the organization's executive director. She says Hope wanted to call attention to how Native women and girls disappear and are murdered at rates higher than any other population. A study by the Urban Indian Health Institute found that 52 cases were reported in 2016. That's the fourth highest total in the nation.
And we really thought that the best way to do that would be to have a reminder that is going to be placed in an area where people pass by it every single day.
It'll be placed along Klawak's main road near the town's lumber mill. Mills says Heidelberg carver Tony Christensen has been carving the pole for the last 6 months.
One of the main characteristics is the representative hand over the mouth, which is really the symbol of missing and murdered Indigenous women of the movement.
Mills says the pole also recognizes Judy Lee Guthrie of Heidelberg. The father of Guthrie's children was convicted of her murder in 2019.
Going to have a plaque at the base of the pole that was approved by Judy Lee's parents. It's a bronze plaque, and it has a drawing from her memorial program, and it has her birth and death dates there.
The event in Klawak is planned for 11 a.m. on July 31st. Well, Alaska's Soul Blood Bank is holding its first blood drive in Wrangell in more than a decade, and it might be its first blood drive on the Southeast Island ever. As KSDK's Sage Smiley reports, coordinators say it's a unique opportunity for Wrangell teens and adults to help save lives and to engage in some friendly competition with neighboring Petersburg.
Once each morning and afternoon, Alaska Airlines flies north and south through Southeast Alaska on a route nicknamed the Milk Run. The flight was named for its unique style of takeoff and landing, delivering and picking up perishables at communities throughout the region. Soon, a new perishable will be making its way up the inside passage from Wrangell, blood.
Blood has a shelf life like milk.
That's Wesley Dahlgren, Director of Collections and Recruitment for the Blood Bank of Alaska.
And it's really weird to say, but yeah, blood has a shelf life of 42 days.
The nonprofit is based in Anchorage and is the only blood bank in the state. Dahlgren says there's a number of reasons they haven't held a drive in Wrangell before. It's tough to ship supplies and staff down on flights or ferries, but also a logistical trouble to get donated blood out of transport boxes and processed in a proper amount of time.
You know, I don't know very many blood centers around the United States that are actually going to send people by a plane with equipment as far away, you know, we're headquarters in Anchorage, to wrangle. I mean, that's in most states, that's a whole nother state.
COVID put a kibosh on mobile blood drives, especially in rural communities like Wrangell. But Sequita Marshall, the community coordinator for the Blood Bank of Alaska, says drives in Wrangell and nearby Petersburg have been in the works for years. So has the idea of a friendly competition to see which community donates the most blood.
Last year, after the pandemic had settled down a little bit, the vaccination was available, we were able to go out to Petersburg and kick the competition off. And so they've had their first round, 2 days getting collections, and now it's Wrangell's turn.
For now, Marshall keeps mum about how much blood the community of Petersburg donated last August.
It's kind of like a secret because we want to see who can do the best just without, you know, giving away too much. It's like a blind collection.
In total, the blood bank will take about a pint of blood from each donor, about 2 cups. It's 1/10 of a person's total blood supply, which the body replaces over the next few weeks. Anyone over the age of 16 can donate blood, although 16 and 17-year-olds have to have parental consent. Only about 2% of Alaska's population donates blood. That's lower than the national average. Dahlgren says some of that could be due to a lack of opportunity, especially in rural communities like Wrangell.
In the 13 years I've been here, we haven't gone to Wrangell to do a blood drive, so the availability for people who live in Wrangell to donate is pretty limited.
Last summer, while the pandemic was still keeping people home, there was an uptick in elective surgeries and trauma cases nationwide, which caused a critical blood shortage.
I've never seen anything like it.
Dahlgren says the shortage was a lot scarier than people might realize. At times, the Blood Bank of Alaska was down to less than a day's supply of some types of blood. And while it's not at critical supply levels anymore, he says it's always more of a wire to walk than he'd like.
I would love to have a robust supply of blood on the shelf where I never have to worry about inventory levels and things like that. But it's a catch-22 because if you have too much blood on the shelf, you know, you don't want to waste it.
Dahlgren says there's a huge amount of uncertainty when planning a blood drive in a place the bank hasn't been before.
You don't know how things are going to happen. You don't know how many donors are going to show up. You don't know if the community is going to be receptive. My guess is the community is going to be receptive and it's going to be a great blood drive. And people are going to be very happy we're there.
Plus, community coordinator Marshall adds, Wrangellites have another chance to duke it out with Petersburg, but in a way that is potentially life-changing.
Petersburg just seems super competitive and they want to win. So. But anything we collect is saving a life. With every donation of whole blood, potentially 3 lives are saved. So that's the big factor. You know, regardless of who wins or if there is a winner per se, we're still saving lives.
And saving lives, they say, is the most important part of the whole process. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
And finally tonight, a correction. A story yesterday said former Alaska Governor Bill Walker had raised more money than incumbent Governor Mike Dunleavy in this year's race for governor. In fact, Dunleavy raised more money than Walker. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early and Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Riley Borden in Moose Pass, Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, and Sage Smiley in Wrangell. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 45 years of Alaska operations. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.